Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
Welcome to a decisive primary night edition of The Source. I'm Caitlin Collins here in Washington, along with Anderson Cooper in New York.
And Caitlin, the primary dominates this hour with President Biden clinching the nomination just a short time ago. And the former president expects to do the same just about 2 hours from now when results start coming in from Washington State.
And of course, the other big story, Anderson, here in Washington is the reaction to former special counsel Robert Hur and his testimony before the House Judiciary Committee today, taking fire really from both sides of the aisle as he explained his decision not to prosecute President Biden over his handling of classified documents while he was out of office.
First, this pivotal primary night. For that, let's go straight to CNN's David Chalian. So where does Donald Trump stand in the delegate count, and when do we expect him to secure the nomination?
He's so close, Anderson. He needs 1,215 delegates, you see there in the upper right-hand corner, to win the nomination. Donald Trump is currently at 1,184 delegates. This is after he won delegates in Georgia, in Mississippi already this evening. It puts him 31 delegates away from the nomination. Take a look if you look at it by percentage, Anderson. Donald Trump has won 92% of the delegates awarded so far in this Republican contest. You see Nikki Haley there has only won 7.1%. It sort of begs the question whether this nomination was winnable for anybody not named Donald Trump all this time. And take a look at what Donald Trump needs in order to win the nomination. He only needs 2.7% of the remaining available delegates. And we're only on the second Tuesday in March. He's going to cross that threshold most likely later tonight when Washington State reports its votes after the 11 p.m. Eastern hour, Anderson.
President Biden crossed the threshold what he needed earlier tonight. Where does that delegate total stand for him?
Yeah, he's now over that 1,968 needed to win the Democratic nomination. He's currently at 2,011 delegates. He also won a slew of delegates out of Georgia and Mississippi so far this evening, and he's going to keep adding to that total tonight. He overwhelmingly just trounced any nominal competition that he has had in this race. So given all the talk about his potential weaknesses as a general election candidate, it never really materialized inside an actual contested battle for the Democratic nomination, Anderson.
David Chalian, thanks. Kaylin? Sure.
And joining me now is the national co-chair for the Biden-Harris campaign and the former mayor of New Orleans, Mitch Landrieu. Mitch, it's been about 1,225 days since the last Biden-Trump election. I'm not sure people are looking as forward to the sequel, but now that President Biden is the presumptive Democratic nominee, what is going to be his priority in the coming days?
Well, I think that what you saw today was really a great victory. I mean, this is a nomination that's been clinched this early in two decades. The president had a great day today. The Hur report, basically today, case closed, not guilty, time to move on. But don't forget that Donald Trump still has 91 criminal indictments pending against him. So this election, as always, it was going to be, and it's going to be in the future, a choice between two very different people and two very different futures for America. You got a guy that wakes up, Joe Biden, every day fighting for the people of America, trying to include people, trying to think about the future. Donald Trump's thinking about the past. He's thinking about revenge and retribution. And I think there's going to be a very clear choice for people going forward.
You mentioned that her testimony today. I mean, there were points, though, where you looked at the transcript versus what you saw in the report. But then as Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal was questioning him, he interrupted her to say that he had not exonerated President Biden. What did you make of that moment?
Well, first of all, that is legally incorrect. When a prosecutor is trying to gather evidence, they either have the evidence to bring a case or they don't. If you don't have evidence to bring a case, the person is deemed not guilty. That's the way that our law works. And that is essentially what the report said putting aside whatever the special counsel's her opinions are about the president in any other way. And for people that are interested in whether the president's up to the job, I just refer you to the State of the Union that he gave the other night. I mean, the president's ripped up and ready to go and is on the job and making things happen.
The real part of this, though, is that his age is a concern for voters. And so what is the plan for the campaign to address that over the next 8 months for those who are concerned about it, even Democrats?
Well, let me say this. I think that it's clear that you have a 77-year-old and an 81-year-old who are going to be running against each other. So age is not going to be the determining factor, not of their ages, but the age of their ideas is. And Joe Biden is thinking about the future. Donald Trump's thinking about the past. There is a clear distinction between these two guys. And I think Donald Trump is going to be on trial with the American people, too, as he is in six separate courtrooms in America right now, which is just amazing even to contemplate. But President Biden shows up every day. He's bringing the receipts. I don't need to go over all the successes that he's had. The distinctions between these two guys is as wide as the Gulf. Just yesterday, President Trump said, unbelievably, that he's going to cut entitlements. Joe Biden said, I'm going to protect him. Donald Trump wants to take away health care. Joe Biden's going to protect him. Donald Trump has eviscerated women's rights in America. Joe Biden is going to protect him. We're going to build an economy from the bottom up and the middle out. Donald Trump's going to do it from the top down. That's never worked before. And so, you know, we're here for the battle. We're ready to go. And the president's on track.
The Washington Post is reporting tonight that RFK Jr. has selected his running mate. And among the New York Times and Washington Post reporting, the names that are out there are Jesse Ventura, Aaron Rodgers, Tony Robbins.
Your name
wasn't on there, weirdly. But honestly,
thank God. I mean to tell you.
I imagine you
what a list.
But can I ask you, what is your plan to deal with RFK Jr.? Because this could come down to the margins. You know how much the margins matter to Joe Biden in 2020.
Listen, every vote counts in these elections, and all of the experts on the panel with you know about that. You can't tell whether he's going to hurt us or hurt Trump more. But that list is just, I don't even know what to say about that. I don't want to dignify it really with a response. Joe Biden's going to get up every day. He's going to try to earn everybody's votes. He's going to bring the receipts of creating 15 million jobs, having the lowest unemployment rate in the last 50 years. Wages have gone up. As you see, inflation continues to go down. And we're going to battle to protect people's rights and freedoms in America. That's what this race is about. And the choice is going to be between Donald Trump and it's going to be between Joe Biden. A future that includes everybody or a future or a past that excludes everybody. And we're just going to have to take the battle to them and win in the battle place of ideas.
I mean, it is a real question, though, of who could it hurt or help more, Donald Trump or Joe Biden? I mean, what is the level of concern inside the campaign about him?
Well, first of all, again, like I said, every vote is of concern. There's really no way to tell. Third party candidates have not fared very well, but they have had impact on races. I mean, we'll let all the geniuses try to figure out what the heck, you know, is going to matter. But all we know is we've got to go out there and earn everybody's vote, continue to talk to them about the future of the country as President Biden sees it. You have a guy that's playing pity plaque with dictators. He had Viktor Orban at Mar-a-Lago this week. And now John Kelly, in a book by one of y'all's colleagues, is talking about how much he reveres Hitler. I mean, you know, the choices are pretty clear about what direction we should be going in this country.
Mitch Landrieu, if you come out as that running mate, I'm going to call you. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Please, oh my God. Thank you. See you.
Anderson, back to you.
Again, over on the Republican side, the former president waiting for polls to close in Washington State, which is expected to put him over the top. CNN's Kristen Holmes has been talking to her sources and Trump World joins us now. So what are you learning about the strategy for this campaign moving forward?
Well, Anderson, look, they've been acting as though Donald Trump is the nominee now for several weeks. A lot of this is trying to talk about how they're going to build out their strategy and their ground game in those critical battleground states. We're talking about Georgia, Michigan, Arizona, Nevada. But the other part of this is really learning how to navigate with these legal issues. And part of that is the trial that's starting at the end of this month. And I'm talking to sources who say Donald Trump wants to attend every day of that trial, even the days that aren't mandatory. So even at the beginning of the trial, when it's jury selection, and it just has to be lawyers, Donald Trump is saying he wants to attend. So they're looking into plans plans for that, and also how he's going to actually compete in a general election and campaign. So right now, they are talking about Wednesday and Saturday being the days that they actually have events, because those are the days that they aren't in court. Now, Donald Trump, he has said that he would go to court during the day, and then in the evening, he would campaign. But I'm talking to these sources, they acknowledge that that could be very difficult. They just don't know how they're going to get him in and out of the city, where it's close enough, what kind of rally or event you would hold. So right now, it's just figuring out how to navigate these several weeks of trial in which Donald Trump is going to be in court. And of course, as we have seen in the past, he is expected to use those cameras to his advantage. But remember, in this New York trial, this hush money case, this is not the same court as a civil fraud trial where there are cameras everywhere that he can go out to. We saw him trying to navigate this when he was in court just recently, having to walk all the way out to this pool camera where he essentially was shouting. It's just not quite as easy. So they're trying to work around how they're going to use those that courtroom as a campaign stop, but also how to actually work on the campaign, because they know that this is going to be a very close election and a tight rematch with Joe Biden.
Kristen Holmes, thanks so much. Caitlin, back to you.
Anderson, we are back here with the panel and also have David Chalian with us, along with Andrew McCabe, Paula Reed, Tia Mitchell, Kate Bedingfield, and Doug High. Doug, I mean, listening to Kristen lay out what this is about to look like for the next 8 months is kind of scary. But if you're a Republican operative, how much scarier is it?
I think it's very scary for Republicans for a few reasons. One, as we're seeing in Georgia, Donald Trump is, yes, he's winning overwhelmingly, but he's lost 61,000 Georgia Republicans right now. He lost the state by less than 12,000 votes. That has to be very concerning. The other thing I think should concern Republicans is in the state of Colorado, Ken Buck has announced his retirement, his imminent retirement soon. There are a whole lot of congressional retirements skewing Republican. We're going to have a lot of open seats to defend. Those are hard things to do.
It's also going to hurt that majority that Republicans are already dealing with that was already slim. Mm-hmm. But Tia, I just wonder, because Brian Kemp today, this is not a surprise. He had told basically everyone that he was going to do this, but he did go and cast his vote for Donald Trump. And I wonder, as someone who is deeply reported on their politics, what you make of that, given, you know, that is something that we could see from other Republicans who say, yeah, I'm not a huge fan of Donald Trump's, but I also really don't like Joe Biden, so I'm going to pick the Republican on this ticket.
Yeah, we've heard that time and time again. Even Nikki Haley has indicated that if Trump is the nominee, she's going to support him. She definitely would not support Biden under any circumstances. So what we hear from a lot of Republicans, even those who are critical of former President Trump, is that when it comes down to a matchup, a rematch, they still think Trump is better for the country than Biden. They think Biden is awful. They think his tenure has been awful. They think that they'd rather deal with another 4 years of Trump than deal with four more years of Biden. And we're seeing that kind of writ large. I mean, I think it's also just like a political calculation. The Republicans who stood up to Trump and said, never Trump, no way, not anywhere, kind of are in a political no man's land. So I think in a way that it's understandable that those who still want to be relevant to the party at some point believe they have to fall in line once it's clear that Trump is their nominee.
Yeah, I mean, David Chalian, we're seeing that play out in Georgia right now. I mean, can you just kind of explain what's happening with these numbers? Because Nikki Haley is at about 14%. Obviously, she is no longer in this race. But what do you make of what is happening there, given that margin that Doug was talking
about? Yeah, but her name on the ballot still allows this protest vote, this non-Trump vote, inside the context of a Republican primary. I mean, one of the great mathematical equations to be done this election season will be, okay, well, how many of those folks just put on their Republican jersey and stay with the Republican nominee? And how many are actually potential Biden voters in the fall? But, you know, largely, I think when you look at these two unpopular nominees that come into focus tonight, the negative partisanship is going to drive so much of this, because politics is always not an either or, but a both end. And so these candidates are going to have to really gin up enthusiasm in their base, and they're going to do that with the negative partisanship that exists in society and playing into the polarization a bit. And then they've got to be able to add to that with some folks in the middle. And in the middle, both of these candidates are suffering.
And to David's point, you know, we've just had a week of Democrats saying Joe Biden is back. He's stronger than ever. There's no question about his age, and that this is a game changer, is what Congressman Raskin said earlier. The game hasn't changed. If you look at the polling, Biden's numbers haven't moved. He had a very good night, But there's been no follow through on that. And that's why this race sort of remains the movable object against the resistible force. And voters are saying, we don't want to see this movie at all.
Kate, and I think that the partisanship, the partisan divide is also the reason the race is sort of effectively stagnant until it comes into focus. And so both Trump and Biden clinching the nomination tonight, that is a good thing for the Biden campaign. The sooner they can turn people's attention to the contrast. I mean, one of the issues we haven't really talked a lot about tonight is abortion, which we have seen time and again is motivating both Democrats. You know, you talk about this base issue. It is absolutely an issue that is motivating Democratic base voters. The coalition of voters Biden needs to get energized and come out. But we also saw in 2022 and 2023, it's motivating independent voters, suburban voters who are also turned off by, who are also the voters who are most turned off by Donald Trump's rhetoric. So that combination is a really good dynamic for the Biden campaign, and they're going to have to try to drive
that. And a lot of Republicans down ballot who say a lot of crazy things. Mark Robinson in North Carolina, the gubernatorial candidate, Kerry Lake, who we all know, they cause problems up and down the ballot. They cause Trump problems, and they cause their other candidates problems as well.
The one thing, though, that Mitchell and Drew mentioned there that they're counting on as well is Trump's criminal trials. He mentioned multiple of them, but Paula Reed, I mean, as we've been reporting, we're not sure that any of them are going to happen beyond the case that is slated to start in New York later this month, the hush money case, which is seen as, I mean, the DA's office says yes. This is still legally perilous for him, but is not seen as bad potentially as the Jack Smith cases.
Yeah, absolutely. If he had to pick one case to go before the election, this would be the case that he would pick. No one wants to be criminally charged in the middle of a campaign season or ever, but this particular case, the nature of these allegations, people refer to it as the hush money case. The district attorney's office is framing it as the 2016 election interference case, arguing that the hush money that was paid to Stormy Daniels was done so in an effort to influence the election. You know, a lot of folks in Trump world don't believe that is something that is really going to influence voters, even if there is a conviction. But he's going to have to be in a courtroom Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday. There'll be Wednesdays off. Look, we've seen in courtrooms across America, the campaign is very portable. He will likely turn these into campaign stops, even though he won't be able to travel. So logistically, it's complicated. But if he had to pick one trial, this is it. And it is unclear if they can get a conviction here.
It may be Melania Trump's least favorite trial.
I think that's safe to say. Notice we have not seen her out on the campaign trail at all this season. But Andrew McCabe, I think we got a taste of what that could look like if these trials were happening. They would not be on camera, but there would be reporters in court. We would have the quotes. We'd know these witnesses who would be on the witness stand. And one of them, we talked to him last night in the classified documents case. He was previously only known as Trump employee number 5. He's now known as Brian Butler. He worked at Mar-a-Lago for a long time. And we talked about the pressure that he faced to stay inside the Trump fold. This is what he told us.
I mean, I think the American people have the right to know the facts that this is not a witch hunt. I mean, he can go out on TV and say this. That's one of the reasons for doing this. And quote, you know, the PRA says this and that. It's all bogus, but people believe him.
You think it's a fair investigation?
Absolutely.
How much of a difference do you think it would make if people could hear from the Brian Butlers, the other witnesses, every day leading up to the election?
Well, we're going to find out, because in a number of filings over the last week or so, the special counsel team has turned over to the defense in discovery the names, the identities of witnesses, their actual testimony from the grand jury. So it is, you know, they're fighting right now in court, as we know, to keep that information under seal and not share it with the public. But we'll see how that motion turns out. In either case, we are likely to see more and more witnesses identified, maybe some coming forward voluntarily, like Mr. Butler did yesterday. And that will initiate a process for them personally that will subject them to unbelievable scrutiny from the defense team. Donald Trump's lawyers will go after each and every one of these people to uncover every stone that might have a negative fact underneath it in an effort to prepare for their ability to cross-examine these folks in the trial. And yeah, it is going to get very tough for them.
He talked about the moment where he kind of exhaled when the special counsel's team said, by the way, all of your testimony has now been turned over.
That's right.
To Trump's lawyers. Andrew McCabe, thank you for that. Everybody stand by. Up next, we are following today's other massive story as the former special counsel Robert Hur and the other classified documents case
told the House Judiciary Committee why he neither indicted nor exonerated President Biden over his handling of classified documents. We're going to speak to former Trump Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein for his take on the testimony and the politics surrounding it and how it compares with his own experience handling politically hot legal topics, many of them. Later on tonight, new reporting from CNN's David Culver on what is happening in Haiti. The prime minister resigning, a multinational security force put on hold, and armed gangs now in control of the capital. His report ahead here on The Source tonight.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Back to our breaking news tonight, as President Biden has now clinched the Democratic Party's nomination with a win in the Georgia primary. This comes after we saw some fireworks on the Hill today as House lawmakers, both Democrats and Republicans, got their first crack at questioning the special counsel who declined to charge President Biden, despite Robert Hur saying that he did determine Biden had willfully retained classified information. Both sides arguing that politics were at play in Hur's report, and one name in particular kept coming up.
And you later joined Trump Justice Department as the principal associate deputy attorney general, working as the right-hand man for another known Federalist Society member, Rod Rosenstein. Isn't that correct?
I served as Mr. Rosenstein's principal deputy.
Bill Barr didn't name Bob Mueller as a special counsel. Bob Mueller was named by Rod Rosenstein. That's a huge difference in how this whole thing works.
Rod Rosenstein was the deputy attorney general in the Trump administration and oversaw the Mueller investigation and his appointment. He happens to be sitting next to me right now. Great to have you here, as you were name dropped several times during that testimony. Obviously, Robert Hur also was your deputy when you were at the Justice Department. With him testifying today, and as you were able to read the transcript of his interview with President Biden, do you think it was reflected fairly in his report?
You know, Caitlin, Rob had a difficult job to do. He had to make a determination about whether criminal charges were warranted, and that required him first to determine what are the facts. And some of the facts were ambiguous. And it's often the case in these sort of investigations. You're not sure what was somebody's intent, what was their state of mind. And so, you know, that's what led Rob to produce such a lengthy report with so many details that reflected his factual findings. And then he had to exercise judgment about whether those facts gave rise to sufficient evidence that would warrant a criminal prosecution.
But do you think that what you saw in the transcript made the report look fair, the way that he had constructed it, knowing it was going to become public?
Okay, now I've read the whole report, which is 350-some pages. I didn't read all the transcripts, so I can't answer that fully, but I think he fairly summarized what was relevant to the investigation, yes.
You said that you agreed with his decision overall on the report here, once it was initially issued, not to bring charges against President Biden. When it comes to the age part specifically, there was this argument from Democrats, pretty overtly, that partisan politics drove his report. What do you make of that, knowing Robert Hur?
Well, that's ridiculous, Caitlin. I mean, what you saw today was, you know, a prosecutor up against 40 politicians, and they have different functions. And I think that really played out very dramatically today. Rob Hur's job, you know, like everybody in the Department of Justice, and he's one of the best people and best prosecutors I've worked with in my 30 years in the Department of Justice, both Democrats and Republicans, you know, he plays it straight. Here are the facts. Here's my analysis. And what does it mean in terms of the legal significance? You know, is the suspect culpable or not of committing a crime? The politicians are interested in the political significance of those findings, but that wasn't an issue for Rob. That wasn't his agenda. That wasn't his goal. And so he produced a report that reflected the relevant legal findings and simply ignored the political context.
Republicans now want the audio of the recordings of those interviews that he did with multiple witnesses, including with President Biden himself. If you were at the DOJ today, would you support releasing that?
I would say yes, Caitlin. I mean, having already produced the transcript, you know, the substance of it is all out there. And so I don't see any reason to withhold the audio recordings, given that the transcript is already public.
One thing that it was strongly contrasted with today was Donald Trump, your former boss's classified documents indictment. Republicans saying that it was unfair that Trump was charged if Biden wasn't. Democrats saying there's a big difference in what happened here. We spoke with one of the witnesses in the Trump case last night. This is what he told me.
On that day, as you're loading, helping load these boxes unwittingly into the plane and handing them to the pilots, Trump is back at Mar-a-Lago. And did you know that his attorneys were there that day?
It's funny because I remember seeing this taller guy, I think flicked back silver hair. I think it was Evan, who I now know to be Evan Corcoran. And I saw a bunch of other people in the living room. I had no clue. I'm just seeing all these people.
And it was Evan Corcoran, Trump's attorney, and members of the FBI, Jay Bratt.
Which, you know, I come to realize now, at the same time he's going in there, the boxes are going from somewhere into a vehicle, which are eventually going to the plane, which I load with Walt.
How powerful of a witness do you think he'd be if this goes to trial?
Okay, then I'm not in position to comment on the witnesses in the Trump case. I think, you know, like every case, it's going to depend upon all the witnesses, and not just the prosecution's witnesses, but also the defense witnesses and the theory the defendant lays out. So I don't think you can comment on how you think a case is going to come out just based upon one particular witness.
The last time that you were on CNN, the immunity case had not yet gone to the Supreme Court. It is now before the Supreme Court. They're going to hear arguments on it. Do you believe that presidents should have full immunity from any prosecution while they're in office?
You know, Caitlin, my history, I've worked on investigations of presidents. I worked on the Whitewater investigation. I was responsible for the Russia special counsel investigation. The issue that those investigations raise is it appropriate, number one, to investigate conduct that involves the president? And then if the evidence were to prove the president committed a crime, could you prosecute the president either while in office or after the president leaves office? Obviously, I believe that those investigations were appropriate, that it was appropriate to conduct that investigation. The question raised in this case, in part, is whether or not the conduct at issue in the indictment was within the scope of the president's official responsibilities. If it was, then there's an argument for immunity. If it wasn't, if it exceeded the legitimate scope of presidential duties, then I think that there's no argument for immunity there.
And do you think that what he's alleged to have done is in the scope of presidential duties?
You know, I don't want to comment, Caitlin, on the issue before the Supreme Court. I think I'll wait and see what they have to say.
So you don't want to say whether or not you believe that he has immunity in that election interference case?
Well, I will say that the D.C. Circuit opinion was a unanimous opinion and was quite an effective summary of the law. The probability is the Supreme Court will uphold that, but it's up to the five justices of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I've got to ask you one more thing. I know you're not overtly political. You stick to the facts and the law, but you did work for Donald Trump in the Justice Department, and there are questions about what that would look like in a second Trump term, and he may marry, well be the next president. He posted the other day that one of his first actions if he took office, and I'm quoting him now, would be to free the January 6th hostages being wrongfully imprisoned. I don't have to tell you there have been more than 950 convictions, but, I mean, do you believe that would be appropriate?
So, Caitlin, I worked for President Trump. I also worked for President Obama and for President Bush.
Yeah, you were a U.S. attorney under President
Obama. And you know, my approach, like Rob's, he worked in all three administrations as well, was to focus on the facts and the law. I don't think anybody who commits a crime involving assault on a police officer should go free. So that's my opinion about that.
Rod Rosenstein, former Deputy Attorney General. Great to have you on here tonight.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Anderson, back to you.
Caitlin, thanks. Back with our legal and political team. Eliam, your reaction to Rod Rosenstein?
So I am similarly impressed with Robert Herr. I don't know Robert Herr. Rod Rosenstein worked closely with him. I never have. But let's think about what Robert Herr just accomplished. He pulled off a year-long investigation of the sitting president. He talked to dozens, over 100 witnesses. He put together a 388-page report, and he just sat there while 44 political members of Congress tried to pick him apart, and they didn't find a single factual error or contradiction in his report. He wasn't flustered at all. He stood by his report. He came across to me, just as an observer, as completely non-political. He wasn't out there to harm Trump or hurt Trump or to harm Biden or to help Biden. And I think he deserves credit for that. It's extraordinarily difficult. Think about the way that Robert Mueller came through his report, right? Not as cleanly as this. Think about the way John Durham came through his report. I think very political. Nowhere near as cleanly as this.
So you don't buy Adam Schiff's argument that the language he used to describe the president's cognitive abilities was unnecessary?
I agree that that particular language was unnecessary, but I absolutely disagree with Adam Schiff when Adam Schiff tried to impute partisan motives on him. Adam Schiff was just making ad hominem attacks on Robert Hur that Robert Hur rejected,
so if it was,
I believe, Robert
Hur. Why do you think he did it that way?
Because prosecutors approach their jobs differently. Sometimes prosecutors write more or less. People could write a 100-page report, a 20-page report. Sometimes they include more or less detail. And looking at that, if I was his supervisor, I would have said, we don't need this level of granularity. This is an unnecessary detail. But I don't take that to mean he's got horrible political motives. I disagree with Adam Schiff on that.
Jessica, what were you
thinking? I was going to say, I mean, the regulations that govern special counsels require them, as Hur mentioned today, to explain in a report that's submitted to the Attorney General the reasons for their declination decisions or prosecution decisions here at declination. So he was required to submit a report that explained his decisions. But the regulations don't specify at what level of detail he has to provide his reasons. And he really, in my opinion, should have exercised better discretion and judgment about how he characterized President Biden in the report. I agree with Ellie. It was not necessary. First of all, it wasn't necessary to his determination that no charges were warranted for him to characterize the president as he did. And longstanding DOJ norms provide that you really shouldn't impugn somebody's reputation unnecessarily.
So if he was aware of that and he did it anyway, is that political?
Well, that's certainly the implication that the Democrats in Congress were suggesting. I can't get inside his head. I don't know what his motivations were. I just think it was a serious error of judgment at a minimum.
Isn't that, am I missing something perhaps here? But wasn't that one of the main reasons for the declination was that if he did go to trial, this is how he would be observed by the jurors. Therefore, I am not going to proceed with this prosecution.
So Hur said that, and he said, I had to explain my work, right? I had to show my work.
Yeah.
But when you actually read his report more carefully, I thought it actually wasn't critical to his determination. And so, again, it goes to a question of judgment about whether you include everything that you noted. He says it was integral to him. So if he's acting in good faith, that's why he included it. But I think he actually had the discretion to make a judgment about what he included in this report, knowing that it was going to be made public.
And let me just say, if Robert Hur had an agenda and he just wanted to hurt Donald Trump, he could have written this report differently. He could have written this report to say, I believe that a prosecutor could walk out of a grand jury with an indictment of Joe Biden. However, I'm not confident that a jury would unanimously convict him. That would have been way more damaging. He didn't go there, though.
Well, by the way, Donald Trump very well may be president again. And one of his biggest regrets of his previous term was that he did not choose to go after Hillary Clinton over the emails. There is a reality, and this sounds crazy to say, but it's Donald Trump, that he could direct the Department of Justice to reopen this were he to become president again. So I wouldn't even argue that this is completely out of the woods. This is something that he has talked about, how he's going to use the Department of Justice in a second term. Don't think it gets nearly enough attention.
Well, look, I mean, I think that, you know, two things can be true. On the one hand, he could have been more careful, but he's not necessarily corrupt. And I think that's what Schiff was doing was saying, because you weren't careful, you are therefore corrupt. And I think I agree with you from earlier. That's dangerous. We do want, especially on the Democratic Party side now, we're going to have to defend all these institutions. We don't want to, I think, cast those kind of aspersions without real evidence. And I didn't see the evidence. I just saw the accusation.
That's well said.
I don't know if I thought he was saying you're corrupt. I think he was just, I think the part of the goal of the Democrats was to ascribe political motives and to acknowledge that you are old enough and wise enough to know that when you write a document like this, you do have some discretion and that it will actually face some scrutiny. And people will look at your words and they will draw a judgment from your words. I think he was kind of more holding him accountable for, don't tell me you didn't know, what people were going to take from saying he's an, you know, kindly old man.
And the fact that the transcripts were released that didn't actually really seem to support the characterization,
yeah,
I thought sort of cast this in a new light, which made it seem even more unnecessary.
It really was interesting that he literally sells Biden, you have a photographic memory in the transcripts, but he doesn't put that in the report. So I think that was better for Biden legally.
Well, listen, there's something in the audio recordings, right? Yeah. Clearly, that we don't know, because if it was completely exonerating, the Biden administration would have pushed those out this morning, and everyone would be listening to them right now. So there's something in those audio recordings that may go to what Hur, you know, wrote and why he wrote it. There may be pauses, there may be nuances that you can't hear on a cold record. cold transcript that we're not
seeing. Well, you can bet the House Republican conference is going to call for those audio tapes rather than securing the border and funding Ukraine.
We heard about that several times.
So do you think there'll be more hearings with the audio recordings?
I think they're going to continue to ask for it, right? They're going to continue to push for it.
And they can use it as a talking point, right? It becomes a talking point that says, where's the audio? Why won't you release the audio? We know that.
But let's be clear, this hearing did not go how I think House Republicans thought it was going to. I think that they thought this was going to be a partisan Republican who was going to side with them and who was going to really go after Biden's mental acuity, and he didn't. He was very nuanced. He was very careful. Yeah. He didn't overstep, and it wasn't the slam dunk they thought that it was going to be. It wasn't great for Joe Biden either, but that was not what the committee had set out looking
for. By the way, another point on audio recordings that, that didn't get really made a lot was that the biographer, right, his audio recordings of his conversation with Joe Biden after the special counsel was appointed, he pressed delete on his audio recordings with Joe Biden, which is a little bit, as prosecutors, I think that's probably in the no-go category.
He provided transcripts of them, even the ones that were deleted, and they were able to get back. But yes,
however,
consider charging him.
Once you get a notice from a prosecutor, there's something going on. You don't go through your emails and start deleting files, right?
For sure.
Everybody
back
knows
to the
that.
Emails, David. Back
everybody
to the emails.
Coming up more on President Biden clinching the nomination, plus our reporting about how the former president plans to incorporate his trials into his campaign. We'll talk to New York Times Maggie Haberman about that. Also, we'll talk to a group of undecided voters in Georgia. Yes, some people are still undecided. President Biden won that state 4 years ago by less than 12,000 votes. That's ahead.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish. So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protests that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Continuing their breaking news coverage, former President Trump is expected to clinch the Republican nomination within the next few hours, just a short time after President Biden clinched his nomination tonight. That comes as Eric Kristen Holmes reported earlier that the former president is expecting to use his court appearances in the upcoming Stormy Daniels hush money trial as an opportunity to campaign. I'm joined now by New York Times senior political correspondent Maggie Haberman. It's interesting, this idea of using the court appearances as a way to stay active on the campaign trail. I mean, both just from a practical standpoint, it makes sense, but it's also been effective for him thus far.
It's been what he has done this entire time. He did it through the primary cycle to great effect. Now, I would argue that legally, his performances in court during the E. Jean Carroll trial and during the New York AG trial did not go particularly well for him in terms of the judgments that came down, but they certainly created a lot of noise and a sense of motion as he was in these primaries in the final stages. And this is what that will be, especially because he's going to be in court 4 days a week. Wednesdays will be a break. So the only days that he can really campaign are Saturday and Sunday.
And yet he knows that so many cameras are going to be at the courthouse and there's not videotape inside the courtroom. So they'll need to occupy their time talking about stuff. So his appearances there will get tremendous pickup.
That's exactly right. And this is something that, we had expected was going to happen and may still happen if there's a federal January 6th related trial where there won't be cameras in the courtroom. There, as you say, won't be cameras in the courtroom for the Bragg trial. And so Trump will go out and he'll give his spin and he'll say whatever he's going to say. And he's going to hope that he's going to drown out whatever the witness testimony is and whatever damaging evidence is offered in the case.
Is he trying to, in terms of campaign strategy, to build his base? Is he trying to just pick away some black voters from President Biden, Hispanic voters, whomever he can get?
I don't think that's what he's doing in this upcoming court case. I don't think that's the target. I think the target is essentially survival, to be honest. And I think his aides are hoping that he does not do himself damage, because as we have seen in recent days, he is saying things that are not helping him. It's not like it's always a net plus when he talks. But in general, it is true that part of their math is they are trying to make a play for black voters. He's been very explicit about it. He also has been trafficking in all kinds of racial stereotypes as he does it, but he refers back to his record as president. Even if he doesn't pick up those votes, even if the public polling showing him getting a much higher percentage of black voters is wrong, part of the strategy is just peeling it away from Biden, either so people stay home or toward an independent candidate.
It is also just bizarre. You think about John Kelly telling Jim Sciutto about the Hitler comments, and Hitler did some good things, according to John Kelly. That's what the former president said. Nobody seems to care. in any other time, this would have been just unbelievable.
There's an enormous a couple of things I would say about that. There's been an enormous volume of information about things that Donald Trump said as president, things that he said in his past. We have talked about it here. We've written about it at the New York Times. That piece of information actually first appeared in a book by my colleague, Mike Bender. Mm. And so some of these things have been around so long that I actually think that the public has gotten almost numb to them. Mm. And I think that is... For people who don't like the former president, that is part of their challenge. If you look back at the reporting around the Mueller report, and we wrote about this at the time, there was so much reporting that went into this investigation and what was happening with that investigation that the public sort of heard a lot of it along the way. So by the time the actual report came out, there wasn't a ton new that the public was learning. And that seems to be the case here. I think the public has tuned a lot of it out. They may not in the fall. And I think that's what we're going to see.
What do you make of the big mass firings of the RNC with Larry Trump?
Unsurprising. And I think it's really mostly under Chris LaCivita, who has come in as, you know, he's a top Trump campaign official, and he's the de facto chief of staff now at the RNC.
Unsurprising because there's bloat there, or?
Unsurprising because they have been telegraphing that this was coming for some time. I think there is not a lot of happiness around some of the celebrating that was going on by some folks on the Trump campaign about it. And it's a strange message to cheer people getting fired, but especially when you are trying to win over more votes. But look, we will see if it makes a difference. We will see if they end up hiring some of these folks back. We will see what the RNC ends up looking like. But it's not a surprise to see this mass shakeup.
Maggie Haberman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Caitlin?
Anderson, Donald Trump and President Biden both winning Georgia in their respective primaries tonight. It's a state that is going, expected to be at least, a critical state again this November. In 2020, Biden defeated Trump there by fewer than 12,000 votes. CNN's Gary Tuchman is in Atlanta tonight with a group of undecided voters who could help swing this election. Gary, how are they feeling about their two choices now that it's in clear view tonight?
Well, Caitlin, what I will tell you is when it comes to presidential elections, it's hard to find undecided voters, but they can be found. And we have found them here in Atlanta, Georgia. This is a very important swing state, Georgia, six voters. And since I've met you all and talked to you yesterday and today, has anyone changed their mind? Is anyone ready to vote for Trump or Biden for sure?
No.
Okay, hands are down. So let me start asking you. First, we have here Dvani and Kashyap, wife and husband. You're not ready to vote for either of these two.
No.
Why don't you like Joe Biden for president?
It's the hardest job in the world. It's the hardest job in the world. And we keep hearing stories about how he's so sharp, he's so on point behind closed doors. But I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it.
And Kashyap, why don't you like Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, I just don't think he's a good human being. And just the things that come out of his mouth makes me cringe every time. And not to mention all the indictments against him.
So you're both independents. Might you not vote in the election in November?
Unless they give us a compelling reason to change our mind.
Scott, you're an independent. You told me that you're kind of a libertarian. You're fiscally conservative, but socially you're progressive. Do you like either of these two gentlemen for president?
Could there be two worse options? Right? You know, Biden is weak in all the wrong areas. Trump is a polarizing salesman, not a statesman. We need better.
So might you not vote?
No, there are too many reasons to go and exercise my right to vote. So I will vote.
Who will you vote for?
I don't know right now.
Right.
Considering going third party, I think.
So who would that be?
I think Kennedy has a lot to offer.
So RFK Jr. Okay, yeah. Let me ask you, Deanna. You are a Democrat.
Yes.
But you were telling me that you wanted Nikki Haley.
Yes, I think over Trump, she just seemed like she was for the people versus, you know, Trump, who I feel like is after his own personal vendetta.
And now that she's out, is there any chance you'll vote for either of these two gentlemen?
Currently, no. I'm undecided.
So does that mean you won't vote in the election in November?
I may not.
You may not vote?
I may not.
Okay, Delancey, you're an independent. You also liked Haley. And you told me you voted for Democrats and Republicans in the past. What do you think of these two candidates, the president and the former president?
Well, I'm not a Trump fan, I'll be honest. But I like Biden. I think he's a good guy. I think he's too old right now. I think he's just his time has passed. And I also think both candidates are so polarizing that it's hard for our country to get behind anyone.
So might you vote for Joe Biden?
If there's not a good third party candidate, yes.
So you're looking for a third party candidate. Who might that be?
Well, one person that I don't think wants to do it, but is Governor Kemp, because I see him
Georgia's governor.
Yes, because I see him as someone who stood up to Trump and is still popular and well-liked.
Okay, well, it doesn't look like he's running. So the final person we have here is Lou, and I should tell all our viewers that Lou and I are friends. We went to eighth grade together in high school. When we were in high school, Jimmy Carter was beating Gerald Ford. But I can tell you, we've never talked about politics in all these years. Until the other day when I found out that you were undecided.
Yeah.
Now, you tell me you know you're not going to vote for Biden. You're an independent.
Correct.
But you don't like Trump very much either, and you like Nikki Haley also. So what are you going to do?
I do. I really like Nikki Haley, and I'm so sorry she dropped out of the race. I thought she was sharp. I thought she really had all the elements of what I look for in a president. But
might you vote for Trump?
Probably will.
Yeah. What about third party?
If there was a great candidate that came in, yeah. But at this point, I don't know if that's going to happen. And I would probably vote for him because I think he can execute on the things that are important to me.
I want to ask you all, if this makes you sad, as a patriot of this country, you all love your country. That's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to all of you. I asked you all how much you love this country, and you all love it. Does it make you sad that you're not really digging these Republican and Democratic candidates for president?
Absolutely. Yeah, I know when we spoke, I was saying that since I've become of age to vote, this is the first time that I really don't know. This is the first time I feel motivated to just stay home.
Well, what I want to tell you is your vote is going to be sought because you're from Georgia. It'll be sought big time. Thank you all for joining us. Caitlin, back to you.
Gary Tuchman, I love to hear those conversations you have with voters. Thank you for bringing that to us. Just ahead here tonight, we'll step away from the elections here for a moment, focus on the political and civil turmoil that is happening in Haiti. What is going to happen now that the prime minister has announced he'll step down? Our David Culver has the latest right after this.
I want to spend a few minutes now on the breaking news out of Haiti after its prime minister announced he would step down in favor of a transitional government. One of the gang leaders responsible for the unprecedented levels of violence ravaging the country now says that they will not accept a new transitional government. David Culver joins us now from just across the border in the Dominican Republic. So what do we know about this new government, when it might form, how quickly that may happen?
A lot of eyes here on the timeline of all of this, Anderson, and it's a transitional council, presidential council, as it's been characterized by CARICOM. That's the regional bloc of which the U.S. is a member state. And essentially, it's been crafted to, at the end of everything, stabilize the government enough to have presidential elections. But it's going to be made up of seven different members, and they're going to come from members of different political factions within Haiti. And they're going to appoint, in the interim, a prime minister, and then hopefully get to that place of stability. But you pointed out the reaction already in Haiti. We're hearing one gang leader who's very popular, known as Barbecue, saying that he won't recognize anything that comes from a foreign force. That's echoed by a former coup leader, Guy Philippe, who is saying that this is not representative of the Haitian people. And there is frustration that we actually heard more than 2 weeks ago when we were in Haiti and in Port-au-Prince, that folks were saying they felt like they didn't have a voice. They'd come up to us and they'd say to the U.S., to Canada, to France, let us make the decisions here. So it still remains unclear, Anderson, if this is really going to create that stability that is so badly needed on the other side of the border.
People are desperate for stability, given all the violence we've been seeing. What is reaction that you've been monitoring from people in Haiti?
Well, when we were with you a few days ago, and we had heard about some of the folks that we were with a couple of weeks ago, and in the recent days, it's been a desperate situation for them. I mean, it's been terrifying for folks who, some of whom have had seen their homes torched by the gangs that are getting more and more control, seizing a lot more territory. Then you've got people who maybe not are in gang territory, but are hunkering down. They're trying to stay safe, and they're fearing that at any moment, they'll have to flee from where they currently are. We were even in touch with a police source who tells us they're really frustrated and they feel like they're the last ones holding the line right now. And they point in particular to the Kenyan police officers who were supposed to be deployed any day now, but now we're hearing that Kenya has put that on hold. Well, why are Kenyan officials pausing this? It's because they're looking at this transitional council that is not yet in place. They're saying that Ariel Henry, the prime minister, is resigning. So they're saying, wait a minute, this is not what we signed up for originally. This is not the agreement that we decided to put our police forces to support. And so they want to see, again, stability before they're comfortable putting their forces into Haiti. And that remains unclear when it's going to happen. Meantime, you've got the Pentagon, Anderson, tonight. They're warning that this could be a possible mass migration situation. And you've got the World Food Program saying, at the end of all of this, we've got to look at the humanitarian aspect, the hunger situation. People are desperate. The supply lines are getting cut off. And you have, as they characterize it, a million people now who are one step away from famine. Anderson.
David Culver, thanks very much. Kaylin?
Before we go tonight, we do have a heartbreaking update, as we have now learned that one of the last six American hostages thought to still be alive and being held in Gaza was actually killed by Hamas on October 7th, and his body was taken into Gaza. That's according to the Israeli military in an update that they provided today. Itai Hin, a 19-year-old dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, was serving in the IDF on the Gaza border that day. His parents have been working relentlessly to bring him home, to bring awareness for the other hostages and their families ever since. Tonight, they say that their hearts are broken with this update. Here's what they told Jake Tapper just last week.
I actually had a dream two nights ago, where I saw the vision of President Biden referring to us and saying, well, your kid Itai, he's on a plane back home. Mm-hmm. And I still hope that that might be able to happen.
Ruby, his father, was raised in New York. And I should note, Itai was the second of three sons. He was a former Boy Scout not that long ago, his dad said. He was also a fierce basketball player and fan. His 20th birthday would have been on February 2nd. And our hearts go out to his family and friends tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. CNN's primary coverage continues right now with Laura Coates and Abby Phillip.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.